Welcome back, after a long break, sorry, to The Jewish Diasporist, a podcast exploring the political, social, and cultural implications of life in diaspora. We are your hosts, Zach Smerin
and Ben Yanowitz. For this episode, Zach interviewed Leah Robbins, founder and organizer of Achva Olam, a diasporist Jewish day school in Boston, which is working toward opening for the 2029-2030 school year.
While that might seem quite far away, many people, including myself, are unaware of all the logistical challenges that come with the setting up of a school. In my conversation with Leah, we discussed the groundwork, both literal and metaphorical, that is necessary for the opening of a new educational institution, alongside more philosophical or ideological grounding.
Whether from first-hand experience or from media like the film Israelism, most of you likely know that Jewish education, whether supplementary or day schooling, at least in the non-Hasidic world, is often explicitly Zionist and refuses to make space for knowledge which challenges the normalization of Israel as a centerpiece of Jewish identity. Achva Olam is an important project to learn from as it's developing a curriculum for young students that includes a robust diasporist Jewish education, rooted in justice frameworks, and presents students with age-appropriate community organizing skills. This sort of education is something that is very rare within the Jewish world, yet crucial to developing a community that not only has a sense of a self-identity and history, but is also grounded in an understanding that nobody is free unless everybody is free.
I am personally very excited to see this institutional development in Boston as a hopeful precursor to a greater constructive focus on diasporous Jewish youth education across the United States and the rest of the Jewish world. Even in smaller communities where it may be unrealistic for Jewish leftists to build their own schools in the near future, we can certainly coalesce behind a set of clear demands to push Jewish institutions towards, as we are entitled to be a part of them. These should include, in my humble opinion, an inclusive yet deep religious education, respecting non-Orthodox and secular Jewish children, an opportunity to learn Jewish languages other than only Hebrew, building strong ties between Jewish children and their local non-Jewish peers, rather than just hiding behind security gates and tall walls, removing any financial entrance barriers and lowering fees as low as practically possible, and without being said, anti-racist education, particularly in regards to Palestinians, one that doesn't just not invisibilize them, but actively talks about them.
Yeah, it's super important. And as always, we'd like to thank all of our listeners. That's you guys, followers, and those supporting us on Patreon. All of you are what keeps us producing this podcast, even when other things in life make it a challenge or puts us on a different timeline. To help us reach more people, please share our content with your friends and community members. And if you aren't already, follow us on Instagram at The Jewish Diasporist Pod. And if you aren't already, follow us on Instagram at The Jewish Diasporist Pod. Subscribe to our shared YouTube channel, The Hamotzi Network, and consider becoming a donor on Patreon. All of those links will be in the description.
In honor of one of our listeners who pointed out that our intro music does actually count as a further ado.
Shout out, Judy.
Without any further ado.
Hello, everyone. Again, this is Zach. Today, I am alone. It has been really quite some time since I have been setting up on my own an episode for the podcast. Apologies for that. I always feel like I have to apologize after I've been gone for a while. And there's always a good reason why I'm gone. And this time is no exception. That doesn't mean that I want to neglect you in any way. It's good to be back. Today, I'm very happy to be talking about a subject that we really haven't touched on that much directly, but often have touched on indirectly. Education. A lot of us are involved in some way. We teach, we make projects about learning and spreading information, whether it be social media, whether it be in the classroom, whether it be just to the broader public. However, a lot of us approach this on the fringes of the institutions that we're involved with or that we would like to be involved with. Mainstream Jewish education is often criticized for many reasons tied to its politics, towards its conservatism, and towards, I think, what could be a lack of inclusion of the perspectives that we hold politically. However, on the other hand, we also often don't get to really present much of an alternative in that regard. There's a lot of criticism that comes from people that grew up in certain institutions about how they were bad and that they were happy to escape it and then they left it and then they have horror stories. But aside from just like complaining and one might even say derogatorily whining What can we offer? What can diasporists, leftists offer as least part of a solution to that? Well, sometimes I pretend a little bit to have answers to all the questions. But today I have the perfect person to help speak about this subject for a little bit and offer something of a positive vision going to the future in a very, very practical way. So thank you very much for being with me, Leah. Could you just start off by telling a little bit about yourself and what got you interested in this subject of Jewish education?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I'm really grateful to be here. So I am trying to build the American, or really the Jewish community's first explicitly diasporist, explicitly progressive, anti-racist Jewish day school. And that dream is really born out of my own experience. I grew up in Northeast Florida in the Deep South. I don't know how familiar your listeners are with the geography of Florida, but the further north you are in Florida, the more southern in spirit, I would say. I went to a very small Solomon Schechter conservative day school, and it changed the whole trajectory of my life. I describe it as it having made Judaism the wallpaper of my life, that really just so woven throughout my day in such a way that it was not an extracurricular activity. It was not a chore, God forbid. And it was not something that took me away from things I would have rather have been doing. It was just woven throughout my everyday life. And as a leftist Jewish adult, I feel like that supported me tremendously. I feel like I've encountered so many my leftist peers in the last 10 years who did not have a deep grounding in Jewish education and show up to our organizing spaces or show up to our Jewish ritual spaces, expressing a deep sense of insecurity. And I have been privileged to really not grapple with those questions of Jewish belonging. And I really attribute that to my day school experience. So I just had this idea one day. At the time, I was intending to start a journey soon to become a parent myself. I've since decided not to do that. But it was originally born out of this dream for my own future children of wanting to raise a generation of the Jewish left that is like deeply rooted in our tradition and can take back the Jewish right's monopoly on Jewish literacy, so that like our comrades can just show up to organizing spaces and be ready to go and not have to wade through the muck of an identity crisis.
I think that that sense of insecurity that comes from not being connected to that can certainly be experienced with people that are attracted to Jewish identity by going from beyond the mainstream. And to some extent, that isn't people's fault, right? That isn't something that, to a significant extent, that's not people's fault of not having had that upbringing. Sometimes that's a matter of choice of the parents. Sometimes it's not a matter of choice at all because it's just not possible.
Or people sort of abandon Jewish life because of political misalignment. And then they come back through, you know, If Not Now and JVP and adult Jewish educational spaces like Sfara. There was an amazing piece in Jewish Currents a couple of weeks ago that Achvat Olam actually got a shout out in. And Ariel Angel says that sort of If Not Now and JVP were accidentally forced to be our everything. Mm-hmm. Instead of sort of just the political action that they were intended to be. And I'm like, that's what we're doing. We're building the institutions that are going to hold all of the pieces so that we can just show up and organize.
This is the article by We Need New Jewish Institutions and Jewish Currents. This is the first time I think we're discussing it on the show. I know there's been quite a lot of controversy from certain people about it. I believe that we need new Jewish institutions. I haven't read the whole article just now, just skimmed a little bit, so don't want to get too much in depth of that. Honestly, we probably could have Ariel Angel to speak about that specifically. I think the metaphor that you said, that the wallpaper of my life, really interesting just from a literary sense, because one hand, like wallpaper like surrounds you, it's always visible. In some ways, it's also kind of a surface level, right? You dig below the surface and there's something else. So there's some literary stuff to dig in there as well. But really the basis of the school, and obviously a lot of people engage in education mostly in their younger age, like in terms of like the institutional level, you always might be learning more, but in terms of like belonging in a school or taking courses, that's something that, you know, you after university, that's when like adult life begins. That's this whole thing. But for many Jewish communities, like the strength of a community to maintain a school, let alone schools, is an important sign for communities like strength and like going l'dor v'dor from one generation to the next. It's interesting to me as well, and what you say about like not it having to be extra, like additional work of being Jewish. Like if you go to Sunday school, that is something that you have to do on top, like it's an extra duty that you have. And that in and of itself for kids who, you know, might want to very reasonably be more outside and spend time with their non-Jewish friends.
Especially on a Sunday.
Yeah.
I'd rather do literally anything else than just sitting and doing more school.
Exactly. So in many places, there's no other choice for that if there is to be any sort of Jewish institutional education at all. But there's obviously big limitations to that. From what you said as well about you growing up, you seem to have quite a positive recollection of how you grew up with your Jewish education, right?
I mean, I'm also... I'm certainly bitter about what was shielded from me very purposefully when it comes to Israel-Palestine. And that's part of the corrective of this school, is to say you don't either have deep Jewish literacy for Jewish children or Zionism. Mm-hmm. It's like, no, we're going to build a values-aligned, liberation-centered place where kids are also going to learn deep into the heart of the tradition. And I say this with like love and admiration for my comrades and co-conspirators. Like the Jewish left needs more than tikkun olam, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, in terms of like going beyond slogans and institutions, whichever like brand or tendency you work towards, whether it be more secular or religious. And even if we're just talking about institutions as well, institutions, you know, brick and mortar, like physical stuff comes with power, it projects power, even if it's not doing so in a big, like obnoxious way. And all activists know what it's like to be burnt out, and having institutions that can guarantee like a good standard of living. And like, that is the basis of community. So
absolutely.
And the thing is, you know, in a lot of places, this is kind of taken for granted, I think, in the mainstream, because if a school has existed for decades, there is obviously some amount of energy that needs to come to maintain things and keep it running, but it is exponentially harder to try and get something out right in the beginning, you know, be the first one to get that energy to get things off the ground. So tell me, like,
absolutely,
what does that come with in practice? Like, how does one set up a school? A lot of us just like, school is just something that existed before us and it will exist afterwards. And most people won't want to come back because they have some sort of memories connected to that. So what does one take? Like, how do you go from there not being a school to there being a school in whatever location you might think of?
I feel like Boston is very lucky to have a robust left Jewish community with lots of educators, lots of talented ritual leaders. You know, Boston is the home of a rabbinical school where a lot of rad rabbis and Jewish educators come out of that. So I feel like there is a lot of rich thinking taking place in Boston. And so a week after this idea sort of came to me one day, I just recruited like 30 of my closest friends and extended community members to brainstorm idea dump. Like, what does this idea look like to you? We had a Google Doc where I was like, type every question you can possibly think of about this school, what it would look like, what your concerns are, what your questions are, what you would love to see. And that was a really rich learning ground from which to build. And, you know, the school was originally intended for Brooklyn, where I was planning to move several years ago. And then I sort of went through a major life transition and decided to stay in Boston, which has ultimately been very fruitful because I have going on 10 years of relationships and connection to the Boston area. But really, I just had 2 years of one-to-one conversations before doing anything concrete, because day schools are not on the radars of leftists, and for good reason. That makes a lot of sense. People hear day school and they hear tribalism, siloing Jewish kids. And that makes a lot of sense because that in some ways is inherent to the day school model. And so we are certainly the ones all over the U.S. as they exist now, which is why we're trying to put a lot of intentional thinking onto how to combat that and sort of mitigate some of the harm of operating a private school in an environment where public education is so egregiously underfunded and abandoned pretty much. So we're just in the beginning stages right now of devising a plan to sort of tackle this on two fronts. One, connecting our future students to their public school peers on a regular basis on school time so that students throughout the school year, you know, throughout the school day are offered the opportunity to build deep relationships and connections and friendships with public school peers and non-Jewish students. And on the institutional side, coming up with some sort of plan for Achvat Olam to meaningfully participate in local organizing taking place in Greater Boston to protect public education. So I'm just spitballing. But if there were like a teacher strike or something, you know, we might solicit our families to contribute to a strike fund, or we would maybe take the kids to the picket line or something like that. So we're in the beginning stages of devising a plan. But I would say one of the things about starting a school from scratch is getting a ton of buy-in from your audience. And we've created, and we're up for the challenge, but we've definitely created a ton of extra work for ourselves because day schools are not on the menu in the alternative left infrastructure that is sort of ballooning with growth right now. So there are definitely some people in our audience for whom this is an obvious need. And in other ways, it's a if you build it, they will come situation. But we're being met with an incredible amount of enthusiasm. It's really hopeful.
Yeah, I grew up in an international school. I went to an international school in Krakow, and of course, a private school. And I felt really that there was a severe lack of connections that we could have had with any school really that was connected to us. And so that kind of siloing is something that certain parents might appreciate because it keeps people within that kind of like social class, or maybe the perception that it keeps it safer. But you know, if we want to, and we were speaking a little bit to go beyond slogans, safety through solidarity is one that is quite commonly touted these days. But what does that look like in practice? Well, that might be something that a school could, you know, come up with a specific plan of going about putting into practice. Yeah, in terms of like the logistical stuff, there's obviously the geographic area of the city itself, like we talk about Boston as a whole, but Boston has different neighborhoods, different communities that exist. So when you try and decide on the school being here or around this building, of course, you know, having gone to different schools myself, it is a big difference in a school that is, you know, built from scratch or one that is designed to be a school, something that is another building that has been converted into a school just to like pump out more money. I know that in America with charter schools, this is something that happens quite a lot, right? So, you know, things being fit for purpose and funding, stuff like that. I know that when you're in the process of trying to get things off the ground, you might not want to promise too much or, you know, not say something because someone can spoil the surprise or get in the way of something being done properly. But what are sort of challenges? Can you sort of give us a little bit of the process behind it in this way?
Well, one of the things that is most challenging is planning, trying to plan concrete logistics for a school that you're not planning to open until 2029, which is what we're doing, which means that like the families, the actual living, breathing families I have newborns, which means the parents don't necessarily have the capacity to talk to me right now, which makes a lot of sense. Or the people I have my eye on don't have children yet altogether. So that just sort of creates logistical challenges. And we've come up with like a creative way to mitigate that. We have something called a parent feedback circle, which is an informal working group of parents of different lived experiences and identities who weigh in on what we're creating on a case-by-case basis. So the families we specifically hope to recruit, but they're sort of representatives of families we would like to recruit so that we're making sure we're always responsive to the needs of our various audiences without bugging parents of newborns. And so that's definitely one logistical challenge. And another challenge is that I'm learning that when people become parents, sometimes values aside, like if something's an easy commute, really will make or break the choice. My parents were really committed. We drove like 45 minutes to an hour each way every single day for me to go to day school. But it's either not like that anymore or potentially not in New England. So one of the things that we're doing is looking at the zip code breakdown of If Not Now and JVP membership to help us sort of choose like a general area or neighborhood. I would say the huge hubs of Jewish leftist organizing activity is in like the Jamaica Plain, Roslindale side of the river, and Cambridge and Somerville. So definitely wanting to find somewhere that's sort of equidistant between those two groups. Unfortunately, that leaves Brookline, which is home to a community of fellow Jews who I would imagine are going to be pretty hostile to this project. So there are a lot of things to hold, but taking it sort of one step at a time. And the other thing is that in order to operate a new independent school in Massachusetts, you have to be approved by the town school committee in which you hope to operate, which means that you have to have the favor of the committee members. And when you're doing a sort of controversial, groundbreaking project that's never been done before in a neighborhood of potentially hostile community members, it's, you know, it creates a lot of questions. But we're working on a really thoughtful strategy to choose the neighborhood that will be safest for our families in terms of actually being able to exist in the school and get off the ground safely. And that will also capture the most amount of people that we aim to serve.
In that case, dear viewers, I hope that while this is a public podcast, you can all not tell anybody who shouldn't know that this is happening, that this is actually happening. I'm sure, Leah, that if this was that important, then we could edit it out. I see also a lot of potential for comedy about the idea of like parents getting ready to send their kids for a school that doesn't exist yet. I'm sure everybody can appreciate the humor of the situation. But it does touch on a more serious point that when it comes to, you know, spending your time at university or maybe even like donating money to an organization, there's obviously like, if you in the end find out that this is not a project that you approve of or that your money's been mismanaged, then that hurts. But I think with kids, it's different, right? A lot of people care about, understandably so, like their future, right? There's a kid's like education being screwed up is a big, big problem for a lot of people, and they'll take it personally in there. So I'm sure that there's like extra pressure with that as well. And something about the neighborhoods as well that's important is that in a city, like especially if this is the first project of its kind, this is kind of what I've been speaking about a lot when it comes to, you know, the Jewish left needing physical spaces in general. And then, you know, you say that, and then in a big city, it's always going to be difficult for people to make it for anyone. And so the argument is, you know, oh, why try in the first place? Well, you have to try somewhere. And then if that works, then maybe in the future down the line, you can think of something maybe that's more suitable, or maybe, God forbid, you know, two Jewish diaspora schools in a city and so on.
That would be amazing.
Right. But you have to start somewhere so that you can go to a kind of situation like in Vienna, where you have four Jewish day schools for a community of about 15,000. But also a lot of people, the kids can also walk to school, and it's like deeply embedded within the geographical space of the community, and you don't have to engage so much in this triangulation. Obviously, especially when it comes to Orthodoxy, you always have to, you know, keep things close enough, but that is relevant, that is important. So when we come to like the actual content and curricula of the stuff that you want the kids to be learning, what is that Jewish diasporist education? Like, what inspiration do you draw from? What is a diasporist curriculum for Jewish studies? Is there diasporist math? Is there like what English? Like what's the sort of language? Like, what does it actually mean in practice? How is it going to be a different school Mm-hmm. With apart from just like, you know, the name on the wall and the motto of the school, I guess.
So I feel like diasporism is a word that is like picking up so much traction right now and actually means something a little bit different to everybody who uses it. So what we mean by diasporism is that we're going to explore and uplift and celebrate the wealth of histories, languages, and cultures of Jewish lineages from all across the world. And we're going to decenter the state of Israel from Jewish identity building, while of course holding that half of global Jewry lives in that land, including many of our own family and extended community members. What we do teach about Israel-Palestine will not be adopting ethno-nationalism as a pathway to Jewish safety. We'll lead with an understanding that our future is inextricably bound to the future of all people. And then we're also going to focus on our roles as neighbors and community members of Greater Boston, and both as members of Jewish communities in Greater Boston and also as Jews working in solidarity with other marginalized communities.
In this case, ties in itself as part of a tension that exists on the Jewish left. And whether you call it diasporism, whether you call it doikite, whether you talk about like any sort of other word, you find yourself as a Jewish leftist today, I would hope, feeling a kind of tension that exists. On one hand, there is this idea of decentering Israel as the center of our Jewish identity, not considering it as all, you know, Jewishness in diaspora evolving around Israel, and not having it so that any sort of differences and divisions, ideological, being connected to Israel, and sort of saying that that is an important aspect, but not being the only one that needs to be discussed, and not talking less about what's going on there, but maybe proportionally talking about more stuff as well. On the other hand, given the genocide that's happening right now in Gaza, we feel ourselves that this is something that's happening in our name and something that we maybe sometimes would like to feel that we have more strength and more power to state. Whether that's necessarily the case is sometimes up for debate, but there is this tension that exists between the here-ness and not talking about it so much, but on the other hand, feeling obliged to talking about it. So I think that this is a tension that needs to be managed. It's somewhere that everybody needs to place themselves, but I don't think you can deny that that tension exists. And certainly with any sort of educational institution, that will have to be considered as well. One thing that I'm actually wondering about is that you go back 100 years and political parties, political movements operated quite a bit differently than they do today. I'm not even talking here about like the Bund, because obviously we could talk just about what the Bund did. But the truth is that every Jewish political movement back in ye old day, in ye old country, but also in America, had its own like newspapers, its own youth movements, its own schools, its own, you know, whatever, welfare organizations. That's not really the case today, nowhere near to the same extent. And so when we talk about, you know, this school or this institution being tied to a certain political tendency, if it's something new, if it's not something that has been sort of normalized by always being the case, it's like video games, right? There are two genders in video games, male and political, right? There are two races, like white and political. I don't believe this, but just this is like the mindset that we have to find ourselves in. So if it's going to be the case that we're talking about a new type of Jewish school, there's going to be two types of Jewish schools, Zionist and political. It's going to be something new. Obviously, there are also like, let's not pretend that there is only one kind of Jewish school, especially when you look at the Orthodox world. But how will you find yourself talking about this perspective to people that might not be 100% on board? You know, the people who might object to the idea of an institution brainwashing children to a certain political ideology setting up in their district. What's the sort of case that you're going to make to them?
Well, the original tension that you mentioned is going to definitely exist within our own audience. There are definitely going to be people who aren't going to want us to talk much about Israel-Palestine at all because they feel like it's giving it too much airtime and really want to focus on the diaspora. And then there are going to be people who might want us to talk a lot more about Israel-Palestine because it is the moral catastrophe of our lifetimes. And so we're definitely going to be confronting that tension. What exactly that's going to look like, I would say, is in the very beginning planning stages now. And luckily for me, I am not one of the educators on this team. So I will not be tasked with having to figure that out. And I will be passing the buck to some really brilliant educators. But what I would say is we are lucky that there are different environments and different contexts within the school day itself to be able to give airtime to both of those things. You know, like a lot of the diasporism in terms of celebrating the diaspora, we get to do in how we celebrate Jewish holidays, you know, get to bring in diasporic languages and customs and all different Jewish lineages. And maybe when we're focusing more on justice, we could redirect some of the focus to Israel-Palestine. But this is a political and in a lot of ways ideological project. And also the hope is that we'll have an organizing curriculum for middle schoolers. Like, it's not just diasporist in that there's like an absence of something. It's also very much the presence of a set of political values. And in terms of how we're framing it to people who would, you know, accuse us of brainwashing, I guess I would just say that there aren't any spaces that are free of an agenda. And the people that I'm sort of going after are folks who have already been relegated to the margins of Jewish life. I'm not going after folks that anybody is expressing concern about. Like, you know, I'm not in competition with local Jewish day schools in Boston, and I'm not in competition with organized Jewish community in greater Boston. I'm going after folks who have been sort of exiled for their political values. And also, I would say that in the name of, you know, there are a lot of folks who feel really strongly about Jewish pluralism. And I would just say that every Jewish kid deserves a robust Jewish education, even the kids you don't like, or, you know, who come from families that you don't like, or, you know, we all deserve to know where we come from.
This is something that a lot of Jewish mainstream institutions, in fact, probably all Jewish mainstream institutions, communal institutions, have to grapple with, is that there is no longer the necessity for every Jewish person to belong to the Jewish communal institution as a form of community protection because we're stuck in the ghetto, because the outside world will never accept us, even if, you know, there's conversion or whatever. There are lots of people who would be interested in getting involved in Jewish communal organizations, sending their kids to Jewish day schools or youth movements, if they were not as they are today. They were not inaccessible and uninclusive in many ways that they are today. And so if the choice is either there is a diaspora day school that caters to that, or there is no diaspora school at all, that strengthens Jewish diaspora communities as a whole, even if people do not directly realize that. And I think that that's a choice that has to exist, because even if it is something that, so a project as yours, that can be done without directly interacting with the mainstream, there are always ways in which, you know, there can be a condemnation, or there can be a really hostile attitude from people in the neighborhood or whatever. In Israel, there are integrated Jewish Arab schools, like projects that have been set up and that, you know, the state doesn't give support to, or they're picketed by fascists and so on. And so there's always ways in which the mainstream can directly or indirectly impact that. And so I would say, for if this carries any weight for people who are in mainstream institutions, is that just because you don't like how something is being done, if it is bringing more people into the community that otherwise would be completely or almost completely alienated, that it is a positive aspect to diaspora Jewish communities. We've touched on this a few times already. What is the role of, like, religious Jewish identity and education going to be in school? Religious education can be done in a completely secular context, or it can be done in a theocratic context, right? It can be done like in a form of catechism, right? In Polish public schools until quite recently, you know, we didn't have religious education. We had usually a priest or someone that was educated by a priest coming in and teaching about how to be a proper Catholic, right? Mm-hmm. So that's been changing in terms of how many people have been doing attendance. But religious education, connection to religious identity, can be done in very many different ways. And of course, you know, Jewish religious identity is very diverse as well. So how are you thinking of approaching this question?
I definitely imagine us serving a group of families who have diverse and, I'm sure, competing, you know, needs and practices when it comes to Jewish identity and, you know, approaches to Jewish practice and celebrating holidays and et cetera, et cetera. I would say that it is a huge goal of mine for this school that our students leave able to use the tools of our tradition to participate in conversations about what Judaism is and is not. Because, you know, I want our students to be able to be in conversation with folks who look at Jewish texts to justify oppression and genocide and say, well, here's the Torah of justice, and what does it mean beyond that slogan? And also, when this genocide is over and, God willing, when Palestine is free, like, what is Judaism going to look like if we're not the ones building it? And so my sincerest hope is that the graduates of this school will have the tools to unlock our tradition and use it toward building a Jewish life that we can be proud of and using it toward justice ends. And if they want to be secular, that is totally great and fine with me, but they're going to do it from a place of being informed. I feel like I've sort of seen a trend of like secular by default because Jewish spaces have been so inaccessible. I mean, there are definitely spaces that are intentionally secular, which is fantastic. And I think that's rad. But I think there are also people who are sort of secular by default. And had they had values aligned Jewish education that allowed them to make a different choice, they might have. They might not. They might not have, but we won't know. My hope is that anybody who emerges from this school can comfortably and confidently navigate any Jewish space or Jewish context that they are part of, that they can be active members of building new rad Jewish institutions and be co-creators of rad Jewish life in ways that are creative and spiritually meaningful, in ways that are recognizable to our ancestors, in ways that are not recognizable to our ancestors, but just to do so from a place of familiarity and confidence. If they want to be secular, I think that's great. But to be secular from a place of choice and not default.
I think also, I mean, this touches on the question of inclusivity as well, right? It reminds me of when I went to the Union of Jewish Students conferences for Britain and Ireland. They framed themselves as being inclusive spaces for all Jewish students. And part of that inclusivity was that they kept Shabbos, took place over a weekend, and, you know, there was no sort of need to use electricity. But there was also pressure that was placed. There was an unwritten rule that you don't use your electronic appliances in public, right? If you're in your room, right, nobody's going to be like inspecting rooms for who's used their phone and who hasn't. But if you're, you know, outside of people, then there's pressure on not using your phone, which is supposed to be inclusive to, you know, students who keep Shabbos and they want to be in that sort of immersive space. On the other hand, you know, atheist Jewish students are used to just, you know, having their phone in public and using it without any sort of peer pressure. And so is it inclusive to make people have to like go to the toilet to take a phone call or to like stay in public and worry that if an Orthodox student comes in, then they will have to like close their phone off? Usually like people can choose to like be with people who will be fine with the rooms will be decided on like you'll be with people who are okay with you turning the light on or off. But the point further stands. And, you know, you can extrapolate to this. Most Orthodox Jewish education is gender segregated, right? From a rather young age, not the super youngest, but as you go further, you know, by the age of your bar mitzvah, you have boys' schools and girls' schools. Is it inclusive to Orthodox students to not have gender segregation in this way? What about prayer? Like, what kinds of prayer do you follow? These are all like dilemmas, totally. You know, what counts as inclusivity and what doesn't, to whom, how do you balance that? You know, and there can be like a positive feedback loop that once you start correcting in one direction, that's who you're going to attract and you're going to lose people in the other way. So these are all things. And one final point that I try and keep, you know, for my own personal connections, sort of one ear on what like the Hasidic perspective on this is. I know there are Hasidic Jews in Boston. There's a whole like Bostonic dynasty even, right? And one of the things that can be criticized with the Hasidic school education system, there are many things that you can criticize the Hasidic education system. But one of the things is saying that, you know, going beyond Hasidic Judaism, that it's like filled with like, you know, misery and debauchery, and that you're not going to feel comfortable in that environment, like that secular Jews are not real Jews, and that sort of perspective. And it's a presentation of it being an invalid form of Jewish life. But then, you know, on the other hand, one might say that is it inclusive when talking about like, how do you want to be Jewish in your Jewish education system, to not mention, would it be inclusive to not mention like, yes, this is what being a Hasidic Jew is. It comes in with certain constraints and traditions and laws, but it is a valid way of existing as a Jewish person. There's nothing that should be alien about it. It should be open and it should be understood. This perspective of like, whether you're secular or not, you understand how the religious traditions and so on. There was an article in the Forward a while ago that said basically that there was a generation up until like the 70s and 80s in New York of completely secular Jews. They were completely secular and atheists in their identity. However, they knew the order of the Seder dinner from start to finish, right? And so that is something that I think is relevant. It's an understanding of what the roots are, what the traditions are, even if that's not something that you personally believe in as being valuable directly to you. It is a value of understanding it and understanding how they differently work. And so I think there's certainly a value that comes to that. But then how do you teach what's the right Seder plate? That's in itself is a dilemma. So you can't run away from this like debate of what is inclusive or over-inclusive, under-inclusive. So just
definitely. I have definitely been in spaces that build themselves as inclusive and definitely defaulted to the frommest, you know, most observant common denominator. I think we would not want to do that because it feels a little too simplistic. For me, we're actually in the process of hiring what we're calling a consultant for liberatory Jewish learning and practice right now. And one of their major projects is going to be helping us put together a blueprint of Jewish life. What, you know, what is our observance level going to look like? What is our approach to davening going to be? I actually really liked at the convening that you and I were at together when we had a morning shacharit service that was not divided up into, oh, if you want traditional egalitarian, go over here. If you want body movement over here, if you want renewal over here. That was the first time I had seen such a creative morning davening practice of, you know, three leaders representing sort of three different streams or approaches to davening, were each tasked with, you know, leading a different part of the morning service. And so everybody got exposed to all of it. And I think that also teaches people to get comfortable with spending some time in an environment that feels like your, you know, spiritual comfort zone, and spending some time practicing or trying on something that isn't what you would normally go to as your first choice. I thought that was a really cool way to do it.
Certainly trying it as much as that is possible, because of course, you know, if you're Orthodox, you're not going to feel comfortable in doing that in the first place. But at least in as much that is possible, I think that is definitely worth trying to. So I know like part of focusing on this principle of Doikait, a chavrut of mine recently mentioned that Doikait shouldn't just refer to like geographically here-ness, like where we are, but it also can be referred to time, right? Not being lost in the past, not running away too far into the future. However, bearing that in mind, running into the future a little bit, once everything works out and Ahvat Olam is like, you know, a full school with a great campus, you know, waiting lists of several years and everything's going fine and you're in the green financially and you get a new Jewish currents profile, at that point, it will make sense for others to draw inspiration from you and to then build on this model. But before that happens, before Ahvat Olam, you know, officially sets its first cohort, you know, planned for 2029, what do you think? And apart from like directly, you know, whether it be funds or like people who can somehow help with your project directly, what is it that you think your organizing can teach us as Jewish diasporas, Jewish leftists around the world in terms of what we could be focusing on in our local spaces? What is the sort of bare standard that we could be thinking of? And of course, I understand that the answer to this question is going to largely be for you from an American context, but also bearing in mind that we also have similar dilemmas on the Jewish left, weaker that it is, outside of the United States and Canada and Israel, believe it or not, dear listeners, there are Jews outside of these three countries. So what does that look like? Like, have you already been in situations where like there have been questions that others will have to ask themselves that you have answers to, or like you managed in a certain way? What can the work that you've done so far offer others in other organizing events or organizing processes?
I think one of the things that we are managing to balance really well, I feel like I've received a lot of really positive feedback about how much we've been able to concretely accomplish while holding the amount of intention and community buy-in that is necessary to create something from scratch, including for an audience, you know, for whom this may not be an obvious need. I don't know if we've gotten far enough for me to like have a list of things that people are coming to me for yet. But I will say that buzz is getting around and people are saying, when you're done in Boston, please come to my community. Please build this here. Like, I really wish that we had this in my community when I was a kid. But my hope is that, you know, one of the things will be literally download from our Google Drive or something and send to other communities is like how to teach, you know, anti-nationalist modern Hebrew, how to have an organizing curriculum that is deeply rooted in Torah and Jewish tradition that is rigorous for young folks, and how to have a day school model where it's not just I do Jewish studies in the morning and general studies in the afternoon, how to have more integrated content to create more integrated whole people. And these are the things that I hope to be able to offer. And also how to talk about Israel-Palestine in principled ways while not cutting ourselves off from the people and the land and not saying that's happening over there, don't associate me with that, but instead, you know, sort of like claiming it as our responsibility to resist.
Yeah, I think that that part about resource sharing is really, really important. I just on an anecdotal level, I know someone who works in a mainstream Jewish school in London, in the UK. And if we tie in all of the Jewish schools that are from the United Synagogues, so that is, you know, all the main, like non-Hasidic, non-Haredi schools, there's about a dozen of them, primary, secondary, whatever. They don't share resources with each other, right? Every school protects its own geschäft, its own like little, fiefdom is maybe too strong of a word, right? But teachers who design their own plans do not share them with other schools. And part of that has to do with like, oh, but we're Masorti and you're modern Orthodox. Okay, but it's obvious that bringing in more minds together and cooperating, seeing what works in one school maybe works in another, would result in better educational outcomes. And you don't have to like necessarily be a parent with kids in a certain school, though that does help. But being part of a political movement that points these things out, that says that there is some sort of alternative to this, maybe not necessarily right away saying like, oh, we'll be the 13th school that will do its own thing and not share its own resources with anyone else. But pointing these things out on a systemic level, offering solutions and ideas to how these things can be improved specifically, this is something that is a really needed shock for the mainstream communal institutions. There is mainstream communal institutional Jewish leadership is very, very used to small groups of anti-Zionist Jews knocking on the outside and saying, like, you are all Zionist freaks, you're all wrong, free Palestine. Like, it's very easy for that sort of group to be painted as fringe, nobody knows who they are. They're all extremists, they're all self-hating Jews, they don't know anything about Judaism anyway. Very, very easy. What mainstream Jewish communal establishment leaders are not used to are people being in the room and like pointing out, why is like all of this a complete mess? Why is there like fraud? Why is there corruption? Why is there nepotism? Why is there incompetence? The people making these criticisms, doing so in a pointed and direct way, with the knowledge of these institutions and with some sort of trust, if not from the leaders, but at least from the majority or a perceived majority of the community that is making these points and actually having some sort of practical alternatives. That's going to come with a certain profile that a lot of Jewish left organizations don't have at this stage. And that comes from, you know, very many legitimate reasons. But like, if you compare it to labor organizing for a second, how would it be possible to organize like a workplace if nobody is involved in the workplace and it's just people outside like yelling at that this manager is like evil or something? Like, you don't understand the internal power dynamics. You don't understand like the structural ties that well, because that's not how these things work at this stage. And so we need practical alternatives, and we need people who, you know, not everybody will send right away their kids to Achvat Olam, but maybe they will see what Achvat Olam is doing in itself and saying, hey, maybe that's something that you know, other schools could adapt. I'm sure that when Achvat Olam starts being its own thing, it will lead to responses from the mainstream institutions and hopefully positive ones.
So, I certainly hope so. But even if we're not in the room, because I sort of imagine that a lot of the people I hope to serve don't think of themselves as being in any rooms with organized Jewish community.
Yeah.
Just to like give our, you know, children of leftist families the same tools that organized Jewry has to navigate a tradition builds our credibility and allows us to take ownership over Judaism. Like, they're not going to have the microphone anymore because we're going to be representatives in a new and deeper way of what Judaism is and isn't and what Judaism does and doesn't say, because we're going to have the knowledge and the tools to do that.
Yeah, you're contesting that space and you're doing so from a place of confidence, right?
Yes.
And really, I mean, I usually try not to be explicitly critical of organizations like publicly as such, but I do think that it is a strong criticism that I would have of JVP. And if not now, for not having focused on this work until now. Because it's one thing to say, like, you know, projects with a few dozen or a few hundred members committed to like one local area, one local context of not having done this yet. But here we're talking about organizations with thousands of members, tens of thousands of supporters, resources in all 50 states. JVP is one that, you know, primarily organized people like, it's like the bête noire of the mainstream. It's not in the room, if not now, is halfway in the room in certain contexts, right? We saw that in Washington, D.C. a while back. This hasn't been done. And I think that it really is a shame, because if it isn't done in the United States, then it's, right, it's going to be much, much more difficult to do so with less resources, less Jews, less leftist Jews and such. So I'm happy that this is now happening. I'm happy that this is happening in Boston. And hopefully it's something that we in Krakow and other places can learn from. We don't have a Jewish school at all in Krakow. And there are specific reasons why that is. It's not just to do with like the small community that ties into it, but it's not the only reason as to why that is. And I think part of the aspect there is that the left in these kinds of spaces in Krakow, in Vienna, in other places in Europe can be that impact. If not creating our own school from scratch, then having enough of an influence, then we can like influence the entire mainstream into at least not backing down from certain aspects. That's a different context than organizing in a space where there's 250,000 Jews in a metropolitan area.
Totally fair. But I guess I would say to your comment about If Not Now and JVP is that, you know, to Ariel Angel's point, that wasn't the purpose of those organizations. Like, they were sort of forced to become our shul and our Hebrew school in ways that they, you know, didn't intend to be or didn't necessarily want to be. And so we're building the organizations that are going to help to relieve some of that burden.
Oh, for sure.
Because knowledge is power.
For sure. It will often be the case that groups and projects have to do certain things because nobody else had to do them. Even though it kind of makes sense for, at the very least, not being the only one to do it. This is a very abstract concept. I'll just illustrate it now. Our Polish-Jewish project, like we have Jewish and non-Jewish members in Krakow, organizes the only leftist library, like publicly available library in Krakow. And so even though we kind of want to specialize in certain subjects, understandably so, I think, we have had to carry this burden of like, there's no other place where people can like donate their books or come and learn about this stuff. It's obviously all in a very early state, but would we like it if there were other organizations that did this? Yes, we would. And there's nothing wrong with being involved in different projects, different groups for specific reasons, right? And
totally.
It almost makes sense that not every group has to focus on every aspect, right?
Absolutely.
Of organizing, and you can be members of both and involved in different groups and so on. Just as we're finishing off on this final point, what can people do, whether in Boston or in Massachusetts or in the Northeast America, wherever you are, what can people do to support you?
It's going to sound so cliche, but honestly,
subscribe.
Pretty much. Go to our website, achvatolam.org, and there is a form you can fill out under the Get Involved section. I personally respond to every single person who fills that out. So if you are interested in learning more, if you are interested in contributing your ideas, if you're interested in becoming a donor and you fill out that form, you will absolutely hear from me personally, and I will reach out to find a time to connect with you. But I would say that at this moment, financial support is the single biggest thing people can do to help us get off the ground, because the people who have their money in Jewish education are going to be committed to making sure this school doesn't exist. So it's going to be up to us to resist that.
It often just comes down to money. 10 people with an idea and with a sense of commitment can really, really do a lot. But at some point, there is a limit beyond which you need a budget and you need some sort of structure around that. And it really depends on how you want to go about it. But there are ways in which 1,000 people donating $1 is better than one person donating $1,000 and having to find that person and setting to their personal interests and whims. You can't escape that. And
1,000%.
Right. 1,000%, 1,000 people. And to get 1,000 people, you can't reduce this to like a small project. It's not about trust, but it's about, you know, you have to also navigate those. I was going to make a point of like, you don't want to just be like a small group of people that you will purity test around, but I don't
Absolutely.
Need to.
Absolutely. Well, that's something that if I could drive home any final point, it's that even if you're not a parent, this school should matter to you. even if you don't live in Boston, this school should matter to you. Boston, you know, God willing, it'll just be the first stop on the journey. And, you know, in 50 years, Ahvar Olam will be in cities all over. And you don't have to consider yourself a day school person. If you are invested in the future of the Jewish left, particularly in the U.S., but really anywhere, then this is a project that you should support.
Right, right. Thank you so much, Leah. Thank you so much for today. And hope to hear more very soon from what's going on in Boston.
Awesome. Thank you.